I'll just introduce Seb. He's going to be introducing the topic for discussion, how was the Russian Revolution defeated, and then I'll throw it open for a bit of time for discussion. So some debate and argument, very welcome in these meetings, but do hold fire till the end. Okay, Seb.
All right. Okay, so on the 25th of October 1917, as the Winter Palace was being taken by soldiers directed by the Military Revolutionary Committee of the Petrograd Soviet, the second All-Russian Congress of Workers' and Soldiers' Deputies opened up, and delegates from all over Russia streamed in. The US journalist, John Reed, who was visiting Russia at the time, overheard the disdainful remark of one of the Congress officials, who said, "These are very different people to the delegates from the first Congress. See how rough and ignorant they look. The dark people." And these delegates certainly were different from the delegates that attended the first Congress, in that they weren't dominated by the elitist intellectuals of the Mensheviks and the Socialist Revolutionary Party from that previous Congress. The Congress proceeded to pass decrees calling for the end of the First World War, redistributing land to the peasantry, establishing workers' control over industry, and in the following months, the Soviets gave the oppressed nations of Russia the right to self-determination. They decriminalised homosexuality, made marriage a civil affair, instituted no-fault divorce. They set up communal kitchens and childcare in support of women's rights, and all of this came off the back of mass participation in institutions of working-class democracy. But if we leap forward, say, 20 years since, we find a very different picture. Women are being driven back into the home, valued only as wives and mothers. Homosexuality is recriminalised. The national minorities have been suppressed. Peasants have been forced off the land to become the raw material for forced-paced mass industrialisation. And the traditions of open democratic debate that were forged in the course of the revolution have given way to political repression. And the masses are absent from political life, and instead the country is ruled by Stalin and his clique. And even some of the original revolutionary cadres of 1917, old Bolsheviks, supporters of Trotsky, the sort of people who attended that second Congress in October, they now find themselves in remote areas of Siberia, in political prisons and labour camps. And in fact, if we were to peer into one such gulag in early 1938, we'd find an old Bolshevik by the name of Virab Virabov being beaten under interrogation by the NKVD, the political police. And in the following month at that camp, close to 3,000 Trotskyist oppositionists, their family members and other prisoners were systematically executed. They were marched out into the snow in batches of 100 or so at a time and shot. So this obviously begs a question, which in short is, what the fuck happened? Clearly there is a massive qualitative shift from the nature of Russia as revolutionary height to just a decade or two later on. So to answer the question, we're going to examine four key dynamics that begin to emerge after October and come to dominate the post-October period. Firstly, and most important to our understanding, is the isolation of the revolution. So the short answer to the question of what happened in Russia is that the European revolution failed to successfully materialise, and the isolation of the revolution in Russia created the conditions for its internal degeneration and counter-revolution that we see in the 20s and 30s. Secondly to this, there's a number of internal factors. So there's a decimation of the working class, both quantitatively and qualitatively. So their numbers are smashed by unemployment and by economic turmoil. Many of the leading layers of the working class are killed during the course of the Civil War, which erupted not too long after the revolution. We see the creation of a large bureaucratic layer, which goes on to become the social basis for Stalin's counter-revolution. And we also see a tension and breakdown in relations in the alliance between the working class and the peasantry. And these dynamics begin to emerge relatively quickly Within the first 5 years, they're well established. Which isn't to say that the revolutionary project is over in that 5 years, but rather the conditions that set the scene for Stalin's counter-revolution are established within about the first 5 years. So that's the period we're going to focus on. But I'll give a bit of an overview of the sort of timeline we're looking at in some of the key events, just so we're not totally lost. So in the first year of the revolution, we see the Bolsheviks achieving the demands of the revolution by redistributing land to the peasants, negotiating a peace treaty to end Russian involvement in World War I, and their attempts to rebuild the economy. And this is where Lenin talks about the need for state control of the capitalist economy as being a necessary stepping stone towards socialism. The Supreme Council for the National Economy, Vysenka, is established. It's when we see the Bolsheviks starting to create something of a functioning workers' government. There's fraught negotiations over coalition with the other socialist parties. There's a convening of a constituent assembly, and it's then its closure when it fails to recognise the new sovereignty of the Soviets. And these more or less involved issues during this initial period pretty quickly give way, though, in mid-1918 to the Civil War period. Where facing offensives on multiple fronts, the immediate task of the revolution becomes its military defence. So towards the end of that war of foreign intervention in around 1921, the crisis shifts to one of internal class relations with a series of peasant revolts, culminating at the revolt of the Kronstadt naval fortress. And that then saw the ushering in of the new economic policy. That NEP period, which lasts from 1921 to 1928, signals a retreat for the workers' government. And it's during that period we see that the German Revolution is finally defeated in 1923. Lenin dies in 1924. A series of faction fights opens up in the top echelons of the Bolshevik Party. And it gives rise to a couple of opposition movements. Both of those opposition movements are defeated by the rising Stalinist bureaucracy over a period of years. And then Trotsky's exiled from Russia in 1929 as Stalin's first five-year plan is being implemented. Forced collectivization drives a large number of peasants off the land to feed this massive industrialization drive. And then by the mid-30s, political repression is in full swing. And the last flag bearers of the revolutionary tradition are being liquidated. Now, we can't cover all the different events in any detail over this period, but rather I'll use a handful of examples to illustrate and elaborate on those four key dynamics that I mentioned. And we'll start talking about the peasant question. So on the 27th of October 1917, going back to that second Congress, the Bolsheviks passed the decree on land, and it was fairly straightforward, essentially backing up with the highest revolutionary authority a process of confiscations of the landed estates that was occurring organically as part of the revolution in the countryside. And understanding what this represents is one of a couple of key points in understanding the nature of the Russian Revolution. Because for the revolution to reach the point where the working class could even seize power, there had to be an alliance forged between the workers and the peasants. Or as Trotsky put it in his History of the Russian Revolution, in order to realise the Soviet state, there was required a drawing together and mutual penetration of two factors belonging to completely different historic species. A peasant war, that is, a movement characteristic of the dawn of bourgeois development, and a proletarian insurrection, the movement signalising its decline. That is the essence of 1917. So we see there's this contradiction at the heart of the Russian Revolution, which on the one hand opens up a space for a workers' revolution in backward Russia, but not without a strategy, a political strategy, which mediates between the different class forces, the main class forces involved on the revolutionary side, the peasants and the working class. And why was that alliance necessary? Well, it's simply because in Russia in 1917 there were 100 million peasants and just 10 million workers. So this is an objective circumstance weighs upon the Bolsheviks. That peasant mass constitutes a separate class with separate class interests. So whereas the propertyless industrial workers are grouped together in large enterprises where they're thrown into a collective struggle against common enemies, the bosses, the Tsar, the provisional government, the propertied peasants, because they're seeking to own their own parcels of land, are a far more atomised and individualistic class with their own sort of individualistic aspirations. So the peasants are able to divide up the land of the landlords in a way that workers can't divide the factory of the capitalist. And this economic position affects then how these social layers behave as classes, particularly in revolutionary situations. It's a large part of the usefulness of why Marxists talk about class. But in this situation, we see that the Bolsheviks are able to forge an alliance, or smichka, between the two groups by taking up this key peasant demand for land. So the decree on land and the implementation of the land program of the Socialist Revolutionary Party is then making good on that promise. However, the class tension is still there under the surface, and it makes itself felt in the immediate wake of the revolution and in the context of bread shortages in early 19, but also in the Civil War period, in the context of peasant revolts calling for an end to the policy of grain requisitioning. But to illustrate this point, we've got a story from Morgan Phillips Price, who is a reporter for the Manchester Guardian and another eyewitness to the revolution. So he recalls going to a town called Vologda in March of 1918, and there he meets on the road a peasant. And this peasant has lost two sons in the war, and he's struggled all his life to support a family of eight off just 2 acres of land. So very representative of the peasant question in this regard, not having enough land to survive on and being used as cannon fodder slaughtered in the war. And these were two of the key driving forces of the radicalisation of the peasants during the Russian Revolution. And so he's quite, you know, a sympathetic character on this level. And he's travelling into town with a sack of flour on his back, which is a part of a large stock that he'd acquired during the confiscation of the estate of the local lord. But he's on foot because he's actually in the process of dodging a Red Guard checkpoint on the railway line, because this peasant had become a mashotchnik, I'm not sure about the pronunciation, but a travelling speculator, basically. And he's selling his loot at great profit, and he's angry about the fact that his sack had been confiscated by the authorities on a previous occasion. And Morgan Phillips Price says of this peasant, "Just as the Tsarist and Kerensky regimes had kept him under landlords and sent him to fight in foreign wars, so now he saw the counterpart of these old regimes in the Soviet authority, because it did not permit him, after he had at last got access to the land, to sell his produce as he wished. Freedom for him meant freedom to levy tribute on the hungry towns." So this sort of hoarding and speculation was a social phenomenon, and it's driven by not just the class nature of the peasantry, but the economic backwardness of Russia, their absolute poverty. This is 1918 we're talking about here. Sorry? I think we're not talking about today. We're definitely talking about back then, but yeah, we can discuss further in the discussion, perhaps. Anyway, the new Soviet state was in no position to overcome this problem by the sort of mass collectivizing and modernization of agriculture, which would have taken decades to achieve, and which would have relied on material aid from an advanced industrial nation like a Soviet Germany. Instead, the regime has to make a retreat, introducing the new economic policy, which allows for a marketing grain and independent trading. But the flip side of it is it also means that class differentiation starts to reoccur in the countryside. You see the emergence of the wealthy peasants, the kulak class, who begin to emerge as a hostile force to the communists. And as well, alongside them, you see a class of speculators, traders, the so-called netmen. We'll move on to talking about what's happening with the working class. So as I mentioned in my introduction, the decimation of the working class is a major factor in the defeat of the revolution. It can be viewed from this sort of quantitative and qualitative aspect. So on the numbers side first, we'll use this, the example of the question of peace which also relates to a number of other points. But going back to that Second Congress of Soviets, we see the passing of the Decree on Peace. It calls for an immediate armistice and for all the belligerent powers to enter into negotiations for a just peace without annexations or indemnities, i.e. without dividing up territory and extorting reparations. But of course, peace cannot be declared unilaterally by decree. And the response of the Bolshevik call for an armistice and negotiations received a two-sided response. On the one hand, the other Entente powers, Britain and France, were incredibly hostile to the idea of peace. So they were desperate to keep Russia involved in the First World War. They want to keep Germany tied down on its eastern front to allow for a speedier Allied victory on the western. On the other hand, Germany and the Austro-Hungarian Empire, they were open to negotiation, partly because of the other side of that coin. They wanted to close down their eastern front so they could divert troops to the western front and gain an advantage there, but also for the reason that a revolutionary situation was breaking out in their own countries. And so they hoped that by negotiating a peace with Russia, they might help to stave off that rapidly radicalising situation. So anyway, Germany agrees to negotiate with the new Soviet government. Trotsky is appointed foreign minister, and he gets dispatched to this little town in modern-day Poland called Brest-Litovsk for the negotiations. And when he arrives at Brest-Litovsk, he's accompanied by Karl Radek, who edited a German revolutionary paper, and who proceeded to hand out the revolutionary papers to the German soldiers right before the eyes of the high command. And this is just like a little example, but it's indicative of the whole Bolshevik approach to the negotiations, which was, to try to promote the spread of revolution, to promote radical ideas, to expose the German high command to masses of people. And they hoped that by that way they'd be able to help along the revolution in Germany, and they even allocated 200 million rubles for producing this sort of material. And as the negotiations proceeded, it became clear that Germany was intent on extracting a very harsh and punitive treaty against Russia. And the question of peace became hugely controversial within the Bolshevik Party. It was divided from its leadership down to its base into three tendencies. The majority position, argued by a Bolshevik named Bukharin, was that of revolutionary war. So he basically advocated this sort of classical Marxist position that, you know, the class struggle inevitably reaches a point where it spills over into military conflict. And he says, "The proletariat unavoidably confronts the task of developing civil war on an international scale, a task it must face any dangers to fulfil." And so his view was that the only principled course of action was to continue the fight, even with limited means, even if it meant waging a guerrilla war. And he believed this would also help bring about a revolution in Germany. In opposition to this was the position of Lenin, and he was essentially for accepting the German term straight up in order to acquire or secure a breathing space. So he says, you know, Germany is only just pregnant with revolution, and we've already given birth to a completely healthy child, a socialist republic which we may kill if we start a war. And yet a third position was advocated by Trotsky, who was for neither war nor peace. So he wanted to drag out the negotiations, fudge the question, refuse to sign a peace treaty, but refuse to resume hostilities. And he followed through on this by eventually walking out of the negotiations at Brest-Litovsk. But in response, Germany renounced the armistice and began to advance. And they met no resistance, because there were no troops in the trenches. Because in the course of the revolution and the October insurrection, they left, they got up and went home. The Bolsheviks demobilised the army. Of the 9 million strong Tsarist army that existed in 1913, only 30 to 50,000 troops remained under the banner of the revolution after October. And it was only when Germany captured Minsk and was just days away from marching on Petrograd that Lenin was finally able to gain a majority in that debate in the Bolsheviks. But the result of all this was that a peace treaty was concluded, but the Bolsheviks had to sign off on even harsher terms than those originally posed. The Treaty of Brest-Litovsk demanded the withdrawal of Soviet Russia from the prime industrial and agricultural region of the Ukraine, along with the Baltic states and Finland. And Trotskyist historian Tony Cliff cites one set of figures by which it's reckoned that Russia lost 1/4 of her territory and 44% of her population, 1/3 of her crops, 27% of her state income, 80% of her sugar factories, 73% of her iron, and 75% of her coal. So this was a really brutal blow, which worsened an already catastrophic economic situation. And there was one other consequence. The rapid development of the working class in the Russian cities in the decades leading up to the war had been driven by the development of the war industries. And with the conclusion of peace and end to the order for guns and munitions, that central pillar of the Russian industry collapsed. And figures for Petrograd show that by the 1st of April 1918, 231 of 773 enterprises, or roughly 30%, had closed down, resulting in the loss of over 200,000 jobs. And this was just the beginning of a longer-term economic crisis. Shortages of industrial materials and fuel was also chronic. The cities were cut off from supplies of coal from the Donetsk Basin and the Ukraine as a result of the treaty. When you think about how Russian industry operated at the time, the technology of the time, it's all coal-fired, steam-powered mechanics and generators and so on. There was massive inflation and food shortages, which compelled workers to flee the cities and return to the countryside. And so we see that between 1917 and 1922, the number of industrial workers fell by 58%, so by more than half, so the working class is slashed by more than half. So that gives us some indication of the decline in numbers. But in reality, the situation was worse than that, because the power of the working class as an active political force in society was further eroded by the loss of its most experienced and political layers, what we'd call the vanguard. So the people who led the revolution from the factory floor. So some of those most capable were absorbed into the new organs of the state, but a great many of them ended up in the Red Army, because when the hard-won gains of the revolution came under threat during the Civil War, it was naturally this vanguard layer which were the first ones to volunteer to go and defend the revolution that they'd fought for with their bodies. So we'll have a bit of a look at the outbreak of the Civil War. So after the Bolshevik seizure of power in Petrograd, various counter-revolutionaries, including generals of the Tsar's army, fled the capital and sought refuge in more far-flung anti-Bolshevik areas. General Kornilov of Kornilov coup fame, he was under arrest, but he was guarded by his own troops, so they allowed him to escape, and he made his way south to the Don region, along with another Tsarist officer, Denikin. They worked with General Alexeyev to create the Volunteer Army, and their plan was to crush the revolution, with Kornilov telling his fellow reactionaries, "The greater the terror, the greater our victories. We must save Russia, even if we have to set fire to half the country and shed the blood of 3/4 of all Russians." Also in the Don area, we have other White Guard generals operating, like General Kaladin, who was the ataman of the Don Cossack host. The Cossack army. He'd assumed control of that region after October, and Krasnov succeeded him, and they ended up commanding a force numbering some 40,000 with 56 artillery guns and 179 machine guns. Further east in Orenburg, Ataman Dutov led the Cossack host of Orenburg with its multiple cavalry and artillery divisions. May saw the beginning of the revolt of the Czechoslovak Legion, which was a unit formed from Czech nationalist prisoners of war during the First World War, and they fought alongside the Allied powers on the promise of Czech independence during the war. And so the Allies were desperate to have this unit transferred out of Russia during these peace negotiations, because they were going to be useless to them on the Eastern Front. So they concocted this elaborate plan to transport them across the Trans-Siberian Railway right to Vladivostok, to ship across to the US, and then to ship across the Atlantic to Britain and France and join the Western Front. So desperate was their craving to continue the war. And as this unit was strung out along the Trans-Siberian Railway, the French were on the phone to them and basically said, stage an uprising. They staged an uprising, capturing numerous towns, deposing and executing members of the local Soviets, and they ended up working with General Kolchak, who probably no one's ever heard of, but for a short time there, he was the self-declared supreme ruler of Russia. In fact, he was internationally recognised as the supreme ruler of Russia because he was anti-Bolshevik. And he set up a counter-revolutionary government in Omsk. Also, after Brest-Litovsk, Germany had occupied Finland, where they helped bring counter-revolution to victory. And there we see 10 to 20,000 people murdered in the space of 1 month alone, and another 70,000 sent to concentration camps, in which many died. Germany also occupied Poland and the Baltic states, creating dependencies of those nations. In the Ukraine, they supported the nationalist forces of Petliura, who, in league with one of those White Guard generals, Denikin, carried out pogroms, killing over 100,000 Jews. And in addition to all that, there was foreign intervention forces. The Japanese landed in Vladivostok with 70,000 troops, but much nearer to Petrograd, British and French forces landed in the north, in Archangel and Murmansk. And so by late 1918, there's some 150,000 foreign troops operating in Russia. And they basically, you know, if you look at where they're positioned all, they're basically surrounding the new revolutionary government from all sides. So it's one thing that I think this brings to mind for me is this kind of the cliche that anyone who's been a socialist or identifies as a socialist for any length of time will before too long inevitably come across this line that's parroted by every man and his dog, which is like, oh yeah, socialism, it's a good idea in theory, but it doesn't work in practice. And it's really frustrating because it only takes a very cursory look at the history to realise that actually socialism was never given any chances to operate or to be built in Russia. From the very moment the Red Banner was raised, was beset by all sides by counter-revolutionary forces in an attempt to crush it. And so by mid-1918, the situation's characterised by this imminent counter-revolutionary threat. And the key political priority for the Communist Party then becomes the armed defence of the revolution. So that much hoped-for breathing space proves elusive, and instead the regime has to turn over what forces it can to defend themselves. So this is a period where we see the creation and the expansion of the Red Army and the fighting of a bloody civil war. But to give you an example of the kind of spirit that was imbued in this Red Army, how dedicated people were to defending what they'd fought for, I've got a quote from a US journalist called Louise Bryant, and she witnessed an early battle in defence of Petrograd in which the Red Guards went out to fight. And she says, in this particular battle with the Cossacks, they were so unused to warfare that they forgot to fire off their guns. But they did not know the meaning of defeat. When one line was mowed down, another took its place. Women ran straight into the fire without any weapons at all. It was terrifying to see them. They were like animals protecting their young. The Cossacks seemed to be superstitious about it. They began to retreat. The retreat grew into a rout. They abandoned their artillery, their fine horses. They ran back miles. The returning victorious army had been without food for a long time, and they were dead weary, but they were wild with joy. The tradition of the Cossacks was broken. Never again should they seem invincible to the people. And it was this political commitment of the workers to the project of the defence of the revolution, which was one of the key factors that allowed the eventual Red victory over the Whites in the Civil War. Having that dedicated working class corps meant that the more wavering sections of the peasantry were, for the most part, able to be won over onto the side of the Reds. But this victory came at a terrible price. Economic crisis, cold, famine and disease ravaged the country. And the destruction, the destructive effect this had on the working class, which was supposed to be, rebuilding society in the interests of humanity as a whole, necessarily engenders severe consequences for that project. we'll keep moving on to talk about one of those other key dynamics that arises after the revolution, and that's the development of a bureaucratic layer. In his work, The State and Revolution, Lenin reasserted the Marxist theory of the state, writing, "The state is a product and a manifestation of the irreconcilability of class antagonisms." And he goes on to describe how the state is the organ by which one class rules over the others. So when the Russian working class seized political power in October 1917, it wasn't that classes and class antagonism suddenly disappeared. Quite the contrary, class antagonisms were at a height, and the working class needed to create their own state to exercise their rule. So to politically organise themselves, they needed their party, of course, the Bolsheviks, but also the trade unions, factory councils, and, of course, the Soviets. In the Civil War, to combat the counter-revolution, they needed to create the Red Army. To combat economic collapse and shortages, they needed to create the Vesenka, the Supreme Economic Council. And all of these bodies, and many more, had to be staffed. They needed their own officials. And so we see begin to see the emergence of this bureaucratic layer. Trotsky described the bureaucracy as consisting of the executive committees of the provincial Soviets and their parallels in the party organisation, the trade unions, the communist youth, the local organs of transport, the commanding staffs of the army and fleet, the agents of the GPU, the presidents of the 600,000 town Soviets, the directors and vice directors of industrial enterprises, amongst others. And he estimates their number to run into the millions. And we also find inside these bodies all sorts of specialists. So they needed economists, engineers, agronomists, scientists, etc. Or to use the example of the Red Army, they ended up employing and sometimes coercing former officers from the Tsar's army to serve in the Red Army, just because workers didn't learn military tactics in the factory. So, you know, the Red Guards, which defended, factories and that during the course of the revolution, were good at, you know, street battles and barricade fighting. But when it came to going into the countryside and fighting battles with standing armies of, you know, well-equipped troops supplied by, you know, Britain and France and so on, they needed the experienced and trained military professional officers to help direct battles and so on. So there's all these elements that are needed, like are drawn into these apparatus of the state, who aren't particularly sympathetic to the socialist cause, but they end up in these important sort of positions in the state. And added to this, over the years, all sorts of social climbers, opportunists, people who wanted privilege, found their way into the state. And then after the introduction of the NEP and the rise of the kulaks and the netmen, we see those sorts of class forces starting to have their influence within state institutions as well. So in this way, we see this state, which was born out of necessity, starts to evolve into a liability. And it's because of the influence of this bureaucratic layer. The influence of this bureaucratic layer begins to be felt even within the Communist Party itself. So over the course of 1923, Lenin suffered a series of strokes, which incapacitated him and eventually killed him in 1924. And then a struggle emerges within the top echelons of the Communist Party. In fact, it had already begun while Lenin was sick. On one side was Lenin and Trotsky, who had come to recognise that a bureaucratic degeneration was afflicting the party, and even some of the party leaders. On the other side was Stalin, Kamenev and Zinoviev. Standing on the centre and the right wing of the party, this troika was formed expressly for the purpose of preventing Trotsky from inheriting the leadership of the Bolshevik Party, so to speak. And during the course of this faction fight, Stalin and co. slandered Trotsky. They prevented the distribution of his documents. They removed him and his supporters from influential posts. After Lenin's death, Stalin created a cult of Lenin, erecting monuments, changing the name of Petrograd to Leningrad, having Lenin embalmed and put in a mausoleum, much to the disgust of Lenin's widow, Krupskaya. And the purpose of all this was for Stalin to cloak himself in the authority of Lenin while dogmatising Lenin's political thought. And at the same time, he opened up the gates of the party to a flood of new members with little connection to the revolutionary tradition. So Trotsky's initial oppositional grouping, the Left Opposition, was defeated by 1925. Then in 1926, the Troika split, and Trotsky worked with Kamenev and Zinoviev against Stalin, but that united opposition was also defeated. Trotsky was forced into exile while Kamenev and Zinoviev capitulated to Stalin in the wake of the first of Stalin's show trials. And in the period of the 1930s, we saw Stalin eliminate the old guard of the Bolsheviks and the Trotskyists in the Great Purge. So whereas you look back to, say, the negotiations around the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk at the start of 1918, it throws open this huge debate. There's divisions in the top of the party all the way down to the bottom, but it's characterised by this open democratic debate, publishing of documents, elections to congresses and so on, you know, which the tradition which the Bolsheviks had developed during the revolution. But then later on, you see Stalin and co. undermining that. And instead of relying on open debate, they rely on methods like, oh, so we found out this person's a supporter of Trotsky, let's find an important position for him in Siberia and send them like a million miles away where they can't have any influence. And so the reason that Stalin was able to get away with this, though, was because of those other things, because of the decimation of the working class, because the working class had been smashed, because its experienced layers had been killed in the Civil War, because people were exhausted, you know, exhausted trying to hold out for this European revolution to develop. Okay. So just to go over those factors once again. So they were, yeah, the decimation of the working class through the collapse of industry and the toll of the Civil War, the formation of that bureaucratic layer within the state as a product of the attempt to create a functioning state in adverse conditions, and the rise of a bureaucratic layer, and in consequence of that, the degeneration of the party itself. And all these things, though, in turn, are the symbol of the isolation of the revolution in Russia. So Stalin's theory of socialism in one country, espoused in 1924, represents a theoretical expression of the isolation of the revolution. And that's how we can best understand what happens inside Russia. So all these problems so far described, from the military threat of the Civil War, the harsh consequences of the Brest-Litovsk Treaty, the antagonism of the peasantry and so on, all of these are expressions of the one central problem, that is the failure of the revolution in Europe. And the conception of the Russian Revolution as being just the first stage of an international revolution was orthodoxy amongst the Bolsheviks, as was knowledge of the consequences of the international revolution failing to materialise. So going back to that second Congress where we started, Trotsky stated, "If the people of Europe do not rise and crush imperialism, we will be crushed. That is indubitable. Either the Russian Revolution will raise the whirlwind of struggle in the West, or the capitalists of all countries will strangle our revolution." And the idea that there might eventuate a European-wide revolution was not some pie-in-the-sky idea either. The crisis and mood of discontent was clear to all. So even the British Prime Minister Lloyd George wrote to his counterpart Clemenceau at the time saying, "The whole of Europe is filled with the spirit of revolution. The whole existing order is in its political, social and economic aspects is questioned by the mass of the population from one end of Europe to the other." And indeed, there actually eventuated a number of revolutionary outbreaks. Now, there was one in Finland in early 1918. Most importantly for Russia was the outbreak of the revolution in Germany at the end of 1918 with a mutiny of German sailors at Kiel. Soviets were even established in Bulgaria in 1918 and also in Hungary and Bavaria, Germany in 1919. In 1919 and 1920 in Italy, there's the two red years which saw the emergence of a revolutionary shop stewards movement. The Communist International was founded in 1919, and within a short year, it became a real force, attempting to develop and organise revolutionary parties throughout Europe and beyond. Now, it was not within the power of the Bolsheviks to just make revolutions happen everywhere. They had to essentially wait for the situation to develop. And that isn't to say they didn't do what they could to try to speed things up or lend support where such an opportunity existed. But in the main, the strategy of holding out for the spread of the revolution internationally was the point of departure for Soviet policy. This strategy, along with the need to fulfil the key demands of the Russian Revolution, are what guides the actions of Lenin and the Bolsheviks, at the early part of that post-October period. But tragically, this revolutionary wave was rolled back. Hopefully some people have been to the talks about the German Revolution and so on. Germany was much more industrial developed than Russia, had a large working class, but it also had a well-established trade union bureaucracy, an established mass workers' party with representatives in parliament. But in fact, when war and revolution came to the fore, it was these nominally socialist leaders of the social democratic parties who demonstrated their commitment to capitalism time and again, whether it be from voting for war credits in the Reichstag to unleashing the proto-fascist Freikorps against workers and revolutionaries. So each particular problem that we've discussed needs to be understood in the context of the failure of the revolutions elsewhere in Europe. So with regards to that, the peasant question, the way to overcome the economic and class tensions that are thrown up by the existence of a 100 million strong peasant population is to gradually collectivise and industrialise the countryside by way of incentive. But for that, you need a ready supply of good, cheap tractors, rail projects stretching to the furthest reaches of Russia, schools and public services, things that Russian industry and the state could not provide without the assistance of the developed capitalist nations. In fact, the productivity of labour in Russia after the Civil War was only about a third of its pre-war level. The disastrously punitive peace treaty of Brest-Litovsk, well, that would not have been had to be accepted if it were the case that German soldiers were at that time setting up their own soldiers' committees and Soviets and declaring their refusal to advance against their Russian comrades. And we saw these things happening, but not till later down the track. And of course, a revolutionary party that had a base in a working class that wasn't off fighting for its own survival in a civil war, but rather was learning the lessons of a spreading revolution rather than a stalled one, such a party would be much better placed to hold off the threat posed by any bourgeois layers that could see its degeneration. So, we say frequently, socialism cannot be achieved in any one country. It must spread to have any chance of success. And all the details of the internal degeneration of the Russian Revolution are merely the internal consequences of the failure of the revolution externally. And the tragedy of the isolation of the Russian Revolution on a geopolitical level finds its corresponding tragedy on a personal level, with the isolation of the genuine revolutionaries. Those who remained true to internationalism, whether it was from political clarity or sheer stubbornness, found themselves few in number and increasingly persecuted by those who lacked political clarity and stubborn will. And so we hear from an eyewitness about a genuine revolutionary in Vorkuta in Siberia, that gulag where we started our story. And this eyewitness says, "Returning from the interrogation, accompanied by two guards, Virabov was shouting angrily and gesticulating, 'I'll show you how to beat someone, to beat me, an old revolutionary, in the face, Stalinist scum, fascist executioners.' His dishevelled grey hair was blowing in the wind, distorted with malice and hatred, and with eyes blazing. His face was terrifying. The guards, clutching their submachine guns in their hands, shuddered with every sharp outcry or gesture and slowed their steps." So undeniably, this is a very dark period in history, but it's important for us to learn about great defeats. Because from one perspective, the whole history of modern revolutions is a history of defeats and a great many tragedies. And necessarily so, Because when the task is the self-emancipation of the working class, when the task is nothing short of the emancipation of humanity from the horrors of capitalism, that victory in that struggle only comes once. And we'll leave it there for discussion.